Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Tulsa World Opinion Podcast. I'm Jenny Graham, editorials editor for the Tulsa World. And I'm here today with Chris Barnard or Bernard. How do I say your name?
Bernard.
Bernard. Chris Bernard is the president and CEO of Hunger Free Oklahoma. And for this weekend's opinion section, you're going to see a lot of op-eds written about hunger and food and different kinds of issues around that topic. And Chris is going to give he wrote an op-ed that's giving an overview of the hunger issue in Oklahoma. So I asked him to be on the podcast this week to dive a little bit deeper into that and maybe talk about some of the other issues that are leading to hunger and solutions. So welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So first, explain what Hunger Free Oklahoma is. Where, how did it originate? What is it that you do?
Sure. So we are almost 7 years old and really started as an initiative of the Ann Henry Zero Foundation when Mr. Henry, as they called him, passed away and the foundation got much bigger. They wanted to do some strategic investments in certain kind of foundational pillars of their giving. And so food insecurity was the first. And they hired a group to do an assessment of kind of the issue in the state and what resources were available to address it. And it became very clear early on in that process that we as a state were not doing well at drawing down the federal resources to address food insecurity. And there were some reasons why for that. One was there was no organization really looking big picture how to connect government agencies, nonprofit sector, and others who were all doing kind of siloed work in the area and bring them together to better leverage the resources available, connect people to them, and address it. So actually the assessment said that if we were just kind of meeting standards other states had already set, we could be drawing down an additional $400 million a year to address food insecurity in the state. And so that's our mission, is to end hunger in the state, but specifically to do that by leveraging the power of these networks and partnerships and collaborations to change systems, policies, and practices in order to get the resources to the people who need them. So that looks a lot of different ways depending on what we're talking about, but kind of the easiest way I describe it to other people is think about us in one pillar of our work. We're consultants that somebody else paid for. And we work with school districts, nonprofits, state agencies, and others to identify best practices on these issues, identify various policies that could be put in place that would free up resources or remove barriers, and then to build the capacity of the partners who are really meeting the clients where they are to better leverage those resources and connect people to them. Another pillar of our work looks like filling gaps. So when we see something in the system that no one's doing that, and we don't find another party who really wants to do it, we'll step into that space. So we run a program called Double Up Oklahoma that matches SNAP dollars dollar for dollar for fresh produce. We took that on because there wasn't a lot of interest from another group, and we wanted to either prove that it worked and scale it, or prove it didn't work and come up with a new solution. And we've proved it worked, and we're in the process of scaling it statewide. That also looks like a hotline we run to help people enroll in SNAP, because we heard from partners all over the state, like, yes, we want to connect people with that benefit, but we see people for 2 minutes and we don't have time to do that. We need something to refer them to. So we started the hotline to do that while we also build partner capacity. And the last piece is advocacy and policy work. So we're in DC, we're in Oklahoma City, city council, school boards, talking to them about policies they could put in place to make sure people have the food they need.
Okay. And I know with policy, that's something that we can actually vote and do something with. I mean, some of the networking you're talking about, it seems like you're just spent the last 7 years trying to bring people together and make people aware of what they're missing out on, that, hey, you're not filling out for this and connecting.
Right. So, or you're a food pantry who's meeting emergency need, but you're not connecting to long-term support and resources, all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
Okay. So hunger is one of those issues that has always bothered me because it seems so solvable, that the U.S. is the world's largest producer of food. Yet, you know, 1 in 10 Americans go hungry at some point. And it's worse in Oklahoma. I think it's 1 in 7 residents. And I know that we've always had hunger like poverty in our society, right?
Right.
But certainly there are reasons leading specifically to hunger, that there are things that we can intervene along the way. And I know this is a big question, but can you just sort of break down why are we have people in hunger when we are a land of so much food? I mean, what are, if you were to, like, you have pillars for your organization, if you were to have sort of pillars for explaining why hunger exists, what would some of those be?
Okay, so the simplest answer is poverty, right? So we have resource distribution amongst people that is not equal. And those who are reliant on hourly wages, low paying jobs, what, you know, get referred to, though it's not my favorite term, as low skilled jobs or service industry jobs, in the end are going to struggle to have the resources pay for everything they need, particularly as prices to things rise. So that's one issue. Another is, frankly, it's not so much related to hunger, but it impacts the cost of things is access, right? So if you have to go further to access something, if you lack transportation, so you're using public transportation, that takes longer. It's something we refer to as a time tax, right, in any of this process. So access is another kind of influencing factor, though we tend to separate between income and access and think about them as two separate problems that merge together. But that's the simplest thing. It's a lack of resources. We talk a lot about, like, we produce the most food. Why can't people have it? And, you know, the obvious answer to that is, one, everything costs money in our society, right? And actually what you've seen in COVID is less food waste since the initial surge of, like, food donations went out like crazy when COVID first hit. But retailers have gotten way better at predicting and have gotten more comfortable with running out of things than having a surplus because it costs them more now. And so you're actually seeing that charitable sort of the food waste going to charitable groups getting cut. And I would argue, like, that's, if you have a free market system, that's actually what you're looking for, figuring out what demand is and meeting demand. And so we can't think of excess food or charitable food as the solution to the problem, because ultimately it's meeting an immediate need rather than the constant that is being in low income and hitting these food insecurity. You know, the food insecurity is a range. It ranges from you don't know where your meals are going to come from one day out of 12 months, all the way to every single day you're trying to figure it out and get the resources to do it. And so I do agree. It's a problem that shouldn't exist in our country. We have the resources to address it. But I think framing the issue as, why can't we get these food to the people who need it? Like, that's not the problem. There is food in most communities. Again, access being an issue, you have to go further. It's they don't have the resources to acquire the food, right? And okay. So that's really how I think about it.
So what are the differences between rural and urban when it comes to food insecurity? What are you seeing, at least in Oklahoma? I imagine it's still similar, but are there... Yeah. Similar as far as access and affordability, but what are maybe some of the differences you're seeing?
Well, so actually, food tends to be more expensive than rural communities.
It does.
Yeah. So because of, you know, it's a smaller market typically, so you prices have to be higher to make a profit margin, and it costs more logistically to get food there. And so food prices are slightly higher in rural communities. So that's one challenge. Access is more of an extreme problem in rural communities, right? So you have to drive further to get to your nearest grocery store, particularly one that's going to have a full array of items rather than just shelf stable stuff. And so that's an added cost that's not calculated in, like, what you pay for the food, but it costs you more that way. And the last is rural communities are, frankly, their economies are a little more fragile, right? So you can get hit harder. And at the same time that your economy is more fragile, the charitable giving side of it is much smaller, right? So a community like Tulsa has big foundations and those things that can help fund the crisis intervention side of food insecurity response. And rural communities don't necessarily have that as much. So at the same time that your having to spend more or spend more time to access your food, you have less access to the charitable side to help you supplement your budget when you're struggling.
Isn't this where having a strong SNAP program is helpful, though? Because a lot of people think of SNAP, and I always have to remind people that they're thinking that it benefits primarily the person who's using it, that, mm-hmm. you know, you use SNAP to supplement and they're getting food, but they're forgetting that they're spending that money in a local store. And I've been to some rural communities where it's a locally owned mom and pop store. And I think I did a story a few years ago on one store, like over 50% of their income was on SNAP benefits.
Yes.
And so it was sort of, that was helping that economy as well. So when those happen, do you see SNAP then coming more into play and getting resources that way?
100%. So SNAP is our largest, most effective anti-hunger program in the country. And it's effective because it empowers folks to buy the food they need by giving them a benefit that's only good for food. And so actually a former SNAP director for the state and I would talk about this, that SNAP shoppers are your most loyal local shoppers because they don't have the resources to go further away, right? They may have a car that's not reliable, so that's risky. They don't have a job in that other community, so they're staying local and spending those dollars. And actually the economic stimulus from every SNAP dollar spent is around $1.70. So you, because that dollar revolves in your community, right?
Right.
So SNAP creates jobs in grocery stores, keeps local grocery stores open. And frankly, like your snowball effect there is grocery store is a great sales tax revenue point, right? Our municipal governments rely solely on sales tax to fund themselves. And so when you lose what is really a cornerstone business, so typically other businesses will surround a grocery store because they know that's built-in clients coming in. Mm-hmm. So when you lose it, you may lose other business as well. And all of a sudden your ability to do anything as a municipality starts to crumble. Right. So it's got these major sort of snowball effects. You add to that a program like ours, like Double Up, we put in Okemah, for instance, as our flagship store. That store went from ordering produce once a week to as much as four times a week. They had to hire two new people just to cut fruit and vegetables for pre-cut stuff. We see SNAP produce sales increase as much as 600% in some of our stores. So that changes behavior, but it changes access for a whole community too, which hopefully keeps some of your non-SNAP shoppers local because all of a sudden you have fresher produce, a wider variety of produce, all those things.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because there's always this effort in Congress and among people that want to restrict items and it drives me crazy. And, you know, editorially, we've been against it because I'm just like, small government, we need small government. I trust people to know how to stretch their dollar instead of being, you know, judgy Judgerson on like, oh, hey, they're buying that fruit juice that has too much calories. And it's like, stop it. You know, it's elitist, it's classist. And I also think that we also don't know what a person's situation is because maybe they have a kid with a birthday party that week and they have to maybe buy certain things that they normally don't do. And they're trying to figure out a budget. And so I'm always very reluctant to try to put more restrictions on. But you do make a point that when given the choice, people do want, and you're experiencing the fresh fruit, fresh vegetables and produce do go. I mean, this is
when it empowered financially and with easy access. Yes. Right. So our incentives only good for fresh fruit and vegetables, which means like you have this money dedicated to it. So you're going to use it and then you find the value in it. Right. And we know that because it's a repeated use. Actually a struggle of this program way in the past was people would use it once and then not again. And so we figured out some ways to kind of market it and help educate it. But in terms of restrictions to SNAP, you're 100% right. So my organization, I said, we're active in DC. It's something we strongly oppose. And one reason is, to your point, small government, but two, I told you SNAP's the most effective and efficient program. It's efficient because we allow people to buy what they want, right? So once you put restrictions on programs, you create barriers and you say only these people get it, or they can only have this, you make a program way less efficient because we have to build a bureaucracy to enforce those and a system to enforce those. And so if you can incentivize rather than sort of limit and punish, you're in a much better state. And frankly, like, our double up program is not just an incentive for individuals, right? It's an incentive for stores to carry more of that stuff because it builds more revenue, kind of changes the market incentives for everybody. And sort of the irony of all that, to close on this kind of limitation of what you can purchase, is it's usually the same people who want to limit these programs and put regulations on it and say who's deserving and who's not, who then attack the programs once we build those bureaucracies for being inefficient and a waste of money, right? And it's right. Exactly those regulations and restrictions that create the inefficiencies.
Well, and that goes, there's an op-ed this weekend among others about food as medicine. And there's an OU Tulsa professor writing about how, and you're right, like incentivizing, explaining and educating how we can use food to be healthy. And I think that's always been the excuse of why to restrict things. But I also feel like it's kind of classist and elitist too. You know, because these are low income people. And so there's sort of this lecturing mentality. But also you mentioned access, because if you have stores that don't have it, then they can't buy it. And that happens a lot in low income areas. In Tulsa, we've certainly fought that fight over and over for decades, that, you know, trying to get fresh fruit and fresh meat into stores is difficult. Is it the same way in rural areas? I mean, are there pockets of communities that just...
Oh, yeah.
So without the double up program that incentivizes carrying it, it just wouldn't be there.
Yeah, no, 100%. There's it's just more extreme, right? So it's like the north side of Tulsa, but instead of having a community 6 miles away, you can go shop in that community's 45 miles away.
Oh, right? Okay. So, they just don't. Yeah.
Right. It's a huge challenge. And again, it's that, like, one of the biggest problems with what gets called food deserts now is dollars leave one community and go to another one, right? So before Oasis grocery store started, one of your busiest bus routes was from the north side of Tulsa to 81st and Lewis to the Walmart. So that's dollars that are getting lost. They're pulled out of the north side and put on the south side, right? So you're losing jobs for your local community, losing all of that. But yeah, it's the same, but more extreme in rural areas. And as a government, we need to figure that out too, right? Like, we have to build incentives and food systems and those things that make that access easier and create the economic environment that makes it worthwhile for people to bring those products to market in those spaces. And I think you're seeing a ton of effort in that in the food as medicine space. So actually, your op-ed's written by a person who's evaluating our double up program for its impacts. But you're seeing huge movement in the food as medicine and local ag space right now in organizing and trying to figure out how to build a more robust local food system. And that is going, the biggest challenge has always been between food insecurity and local ag. How do you actually make it affordable for low income folks? Local ag has really been a thing that's affordable to those with expendable incomes. And that's all about economy of scale and pooling resources. And I think we're on our way there. But it's going to take some time.
I've written a column for this weekend, because one of the things that I know that's been lost, and people talk about how schools were, which is the idea of cooking. And then I talk about food waste and how I was taught to cook. You don't waste anything. I mean, everything has a use. But I was talking to a local food bank years ago, and they came up with the problem of, they gave a young woman like just beans, dry beans, and she had no idea how to cook it. Yeah. And so there's something about, when you talk about food as medicine, we also have to figure out a way to bring that knowledge and skill of cooking back. And I always tell people, it's not coming back to schools. Sorry, the schools are overburdened as it is. But I do see some groups like the Food on the Move going into elementary schools and faith institutions having cooking classes. And I can kind of see this world where we need to have more of kind of teaching that again to each other. People talk about, you know, whatever it was in schools, or it used to, home economics. Home economics is gone by the time I got to school. But I kind of see that need going into that too, that if you're going to have fresh fruits and vegetables, you're going to have to teach people how to cook it. So I can kind of see a need there that the community as a whole can figure out how to do as well.
Yeah. So I think that you, I kind of think of responses in two buckets. So there's systemic responses and then community responses, right? And some things like SNAP is a systemic response. It's available to anyone who meets the certain thresholds to go. A community response looks more like a food on the move or a cooking class at a local church or those sorts of things. And you need both, and you need them to be interacting, right? So like our Double Up program has recipe cards that we'll put in to teach people. But I think we also need to think about, so you heard me reference time tax. So people in poverty now versus people in poverty and say like when you and I were growing up, it does look different. Your standard work days are very different. A mother, single mom in poverty is probably working two jobs and trying to figure out how to manage all that. I struggle. My wife stays home and we struggle to have home cooked meals every night, right? Like it is just hard. There's a lot of things to do. When you're in poverty and you have to say, take a bus to your grocery store, you just lost 2 hours. That takes me 15 minutes, right? Like each thing takes longer. And so also, I mean, that's why these shelf stable things have gotten so popular, right? It's ease. And so I think what I always caution people against is, yes, we need to do that. But frankly, it's not just poor folks who need to learn that. It's all of us across the board.
Like, right. We all need to know how to make a week's worth of food at one time,
which is how I grew up, right? I grew up with you make rice, you make a whole bunch of broccoli, and you bake some chicken, and that's our meal for the week because my mom was at work every day, you know. You have to think about all that, but like I'll still have people. So, summer meals is a great example in rural Oklahoma. Summer meals need to be shelf stable, they just do. But people want these fresh meals and they want it to be, you know, nutrient rich, which, by the way, the products are nutrient rich, even though they're shelf stable because they're required to be. But if I have a 4-year-old living in extreme poverty in Oklahoma, in rural Oklahoma, they may not have a microwave. They, right? We don't want them using a stove. So what will they actually eat? And that's kind of how you have to. We have to think about meeting folks where they are and improving systems overall. But yeah, as a state, I mean, I moved to Oklahoma and I gained 35 pounds. You know, like we've got to get better overall at doing that.
So you had mentioned in your op-ed that there was a recent gathering where your group sort of gathered 300 individuals across Oklahoma. And these are all people who work in the area of hunger and food. And from what I understand, from what I read, it was all about having a deeper discussion to how everyone can do better. So can you explain a little bit about what were those workshops about and, you know, what resulted? I mean, what were some of the discussions that were had?
Well, to go through all the discussions would take way more So we kind of had tracks, right? So we had, how can the charitable sector better leverage government programs? We had a food equity and food justice track, hunger and health. So talking exactly about what you and I were just talking, because we know hunger impacts obesity, heart disease, diabetes, blah, 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 right? Down the list of all the things that we have the highest occurrences of within the country. And then this kind of model of hunger-free communities, like how do you build community response and build up based on the needs, as well as some advocacy work. And so what we saw is a ton of energy of folks of, I didn't know that was happening. I didn't think about being able to do this, and kind of drawing ideas in to take back to their other communities. We saw a continued, I'd say since we started 7 years ago, like when I started 7 years ago, it was a badge of pride for most nonprofits that worked in food insecurity to say, we take no government money, right? And instead people saying, wait a minute, it takes all these resources to solve it. So making connections with state agencies and others saying, how can we work together? How can you help the clients I serve, and vice versa? And then we saw a ton of movement and energy around how do we include the voice of people who are actually impacted by the issue. So in our world, the term of art is lived experience. How do you take the expertise people have from living in poverty, right, and take it and translate it into policy work and changes in your program? Because I think too often government agencies, nonprofits, everyone We are under pressure to say we're making things the most efficient for us and the most cost effective for us. And too often that's at the sacrifice of what's efficient and cost effective for the people who are needing the resource. And so having those people at the table and informing the changes that happen, I think is probably where we saw the most energy. That and frankly, just again, term of art, but public-private partnerships or P3s as they get referred to, which is how do we all work together collectively and move lockstep, solve the problem? Because that's the only way you do it, right? A stat I often say that gets misinterpreted, so I'll do my best to give it to you and give context. The food safety net overall is 92 to 94% federal dollars. The other 6% is charitable dollars. And that 6% is badly needed because it meets people where they are. It meets them fast, right? You reference food on the move and a food bank. Like, they can come to you when you're in crisis. They can respond to an emergency immediately, and they bring the immediate box of food you need for that day or that week. But the scale of the problem, so to your point, right, 1 in 5 kids, 1 in 7 households in the state, the scale of the problem requires the scale that only government has and only federal government has, frankly. And, you know, we already, at this point, it's around $1.6 billion, maybe $2 billion a year, depending on how you count programs, of federal dollars coming in to address that issue every year in the state.
Yeah, and I remember hearing people talk about, and it's interesting, you talk about how it used to be a badge of honor, not right, to give them money, but the people who I knew who worked in it, and there was always this kind of, you know, pushback on, well, we'll just have the faith institutions handle it instead of federal government. And I remember some of the churches said there is no way that that could shift. There is no capacity in the nonprofit and faith worlds that could replace what the federal government brings. Right. But you're right. I mean, they're bringing this resource, but we still need the people to interact and bring that face to face.
Oh, 100%, right? So we actually another thing that got a ton of excitement at our conference, we called SNAP work planning, and there were optional breakout groups by region where people could come. We'd show them data and then show them current reach of a network. So for 4 years, we've been working with the state and 2 food banks to build a network of SNAP partners who anyone can go in and get them enrolled in SNAP. And we are now in every single county at least. So it's this cool map of all these dots that connect, right? So it's like a visualization of what a safety net really looks like. And that's churches and that's nonprofits. Like, you have to meet people where they are and where they have trust, but you have to bring resources there because there is our entire charitable community cannot replace even the existing federal resources that are there, right? Like I told you, over $1 billion a year, like that's just not possible. And so the other challenge here is when you hit an economic downturn, everyone is impacted. Not your low income folks are impacted worse, but your high income are too. So actually what you see is need rises and resources from the charitable sector drop. And so all of a sudden it's this huge crisis, but the government programs are designed to say, oh, needs rising, program expands and we meet it because it's going to stimulate the economy because we're putting dollars back in it, right? So you have to have those programs or we will never solve the issue.
So you mentioned the kids, that 1 in 5 Oklahoma kids experience hunger at some point, and that's more than the adult rate. So there's been, and Representative John Waldron's writing at NOPID this weekend on, you know, some of the USDA changes that'll help expand, you know, I'm calling it the free meal access. I mean, some states are going to just universal access. And in Tulsa Public Schools, my kids were in elementary when Tulsa Public Schools was able to use changes in a USDA policy to allow for all kids to get free lunches at the elementary level. And it was wonderful. I mean, having experience, I mean, my kids didn't technically qualify, but because they were in TPS and qualified, it took, one of the things that immediately just took away a stigma. Yes. It took away lunch debt from families who are struggling, you know, because there are always families right above the eligibility and they're just struggling. So that went away, and then the stigma went away, and it was wonderful. So, and I know that there are a couple of Representative Waldron, Representative Boatman are pushing this, but I am kind of curious, what was there any talk about what is, and it make, I don't want to add things to schools. Schools need, you know, they're always looked at as trying to solve, you know, communities' problems. But I did remember during the pandemic that they took away the congregate meal requirement. So like people could just go and pick up meals, and take it home in the summer instead of having to eat it on site. I mean, are there, what is the talk about what can be done around kids, around schools, around kind of expanding food access, particularly there?
So there's a lot of talk.
Well, yeah.
I think we're seeing actually great interest in it. And we do public polling every year or every other year to kind of see where people are. And even prior to the pandemic, most Oklahomans, a majority, said they would support giving more access to free meals to kids in schools.
So when you say that, does that mean they're wanting to take like our tax money, Oklahoma tax money, toward making? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's nice. No, we do have $5 billion in savings accounts.
Right. And it's all about not, we don't politicize language when we put that stuff in. Once
I know, but
it gets hard.
I'm an editorial writer. I'm putting it, that's how my mind works.
But, so there was talk at the federal level. So to your point, during the pandemic, anyone could eat for free anytime. TPS does it in elementary schools and other districts do it district-wide or in certain schools via a program called community eligibility provision, which is actually determined by how many kids you have on SNAP, in foster care, homeless, TANF, and FDPIR. And I won't bore folks with what all those acronyms mean, but it means you're in poverty. We've actually worked with the state a few years ago to now include Medicaid in that number too. So that's happening this year. So it's going to make it more financially viable for more schools. What Rep. Waldron has submitted, and have to give a shout out to him because he was my high school AP comparative government teacher and to Booker T. But what he's saying is, let's feed every kid for free, but let's leverage that program to get every federal dollar we can. Mm-hmm. Right, in order to get there. And you're seeing that movement across the country. Different states are taking different approaches. Like Arkansas is just covering reduced price lunch, so it's the same as free, which is actually where you see a lot of your school meal debt, to your point, is those reduced price kids. And the kids right on that benefit cliff is what we call it, who all of a sudden, what the irony of some of these benefit cutoffs. So SNAP eligibility cuts off at 130% of the poverty line. So does free lunch eligibility. So you get to 131% of the poverty line, all of a sudden you lose all your SNAP benefits and your kids have to pay for school meals and you lose another benefit, right?
Is it being worse for you?
Right. It's a disincentive to making more money or working. And so I think that's where you're hearing everyone kind of on both sides of the aisle start to get it a little bit. We certainly still have people who say you're expanding a mandate or whatever, but I'm pretty confident in the next year or two, the state of Oklahoma is going to do something big on school meals and giving more kids access. What exactly it will look like, I think, is a legislative compromise question. Whether you do it by income threshold, so you say now it's 250% of poverty line, and the state will cover that difference, or whether you do it via CEP and the community eligibility provision and expand the number of districts that feed every kid for free. I think there are a lot of options there. Now let's go to summer meals and this non-congregate congregate. So actually, that non-congregate piece was one of the few lessons learned that the feds actually then adopted in some form permanently. But it's only for rural Oklahoma because they, you know, you have to travel further, all those things. It made sense to everybody that at least in rural non-congregate makes sense. So you're going to see that really. This summer is when you're going to see all the regs are out and hopefully we'll be able to expand that in the state because we've been worse in summer meals for years in Oklahoma. And that's an access problem. That's how rural we are and how many folks leverage the program. And I think we're to a point where lots of people want to leverage it, but that congregate was a barrier that's now removed in a lot of communities. So we're really hopeful about what that'll bring. But I think that's the other challenge is we learned during the pandemic. So I don't think I'd talk about it in the op-ed, but there's been news stories out about it since then. USDA showed their food insecurity numbers. They issue them every 3 years. And what you saw is over the course of the pandemic, you actually saw food insecurity drop because of all the responses we put out. And we are now on the steepest incline of food insecurity that you've seen since the recession in 2008, 2009. And that's because all those resources have gone away. So we now know what works, right?
And so but we never learned. So like the congregate, and when we say congregate, what for people who don't know, it's you used to have to, in the summer meal program, kids would go and you'd have to eat it on site. Yep. Rather than going, picking it up, taking it home. And I always thought that was weird. So
every meal, right? So like you're talking about a kid who has to go 5 miles twice a day, has to go there. If their parents working, they're not going to let their kid outside. Or you don't want them taking off work to take their kid there, because that, again, that's undermining what we're trying to do, right? So non-congregate says you can pick up to a week's worth of meals at once at a site and take it home. That way, you know, your kid's got the food at home. You can go to work, or you can go to your VoTech program or whatever it is and know your kid's got what they need at home.
And it worked. So they kept that. Anything else from the pandemic that they're going to bring back or realize?
So pandemic EBT was a program that worked like SNAP, that replaced meals you missed with a cash equivalent benefit, only good towards food and stores on a card. That is being kept. There are frankly some hurdles around it. So what you're seeing right now is it requires a 50% match to administer the program from the state, and it requires you meet all these regulations around who's eligible and who's not. And so that requires data sharing between government agencies and some other things. It's OSD and DHS here in our state that have to work together. And I know that they're both committed to trying to figure it out. Whether it happens this summer or not, I honestly can't say right now, but I think long-term it happens. And that'll be a $60 per kid per month benefit in the summer to help families afford food. And honestly, if you look at that versus summer meals, if we care about local economies and local workforce, it's a better program, right? Because you're spending those dollars there and you're stimulating economies at the same time that you're supporting families that are struggling. So you'll see that program probably roll out in around 50% of states this summer, and the other hopefully 50% of states the next summer, as they all try and figure out the financial and administrative stuff around it.
See, and then we'll bring a bunch of teenagers on here next to talk about the quality of school meals, because that's a whole other hour that I know teenagers have feel very strongly about.
Well, but let me say something about it, though, because I actually get hammered about this all the time. Like, they're not even hungry. They don't want to eat the food, whatever that is. So if we care about the quality of school meals, we should care about feeding every kid for free, because it's frankly an economies of scale problem. So the more you make it available and the more a school knows they have guaranteed revenue, the more they're able to pay for higher quality products, think about staffing in different ways, and the more they leverage all these programs. So school should be offering breakfast, lunch, and after school meals every day, right? They just should. Those are all programs available to them. And it's a capacity and a resource problem, because you've got to get to a certain level of use of those programs to be able to afford the overhead that comes with them. And so, I mean, this is what I tell everyone all the time. Let's make sure every kid can eat and that schools know they're going to get the money back for that. And then you're going to see higher quality meals. You just don't.
Because I did, during that time we were picking up meals, I'm like, okay, my kids really weren't lying on some of this. So I thought they were, I'm like, okay. Well, yes.
And it's also a struggle to produce that many meals. And so, there's a lot of challenges there. But I mean, honestly, what we hear from schools right now is, just like everywhere else, it's a workforce problem too. Like, those are not high paying jobs because the reimbursements are not high for running those programs. And so when people look at what job makes sense for me, that is not their first choice often, unless it's a passion of theirs, because other jobs may offer higher wages, better benefits, that sort of stuff.
Well, we have spoken about quite a bit, but there's a lot to read this weekend for people who are interested in this issue. And I am, because I feel like this is such a solvable thing. I mean, yes, we have big systems things, but then there are things individually we can do, whether it's, I wrote about food waste, but you know, partnerships and just being involved. But I want to, with everyone, I want to give the guests the last word. So what are some final thoughts or things you want to leave with as we sign off here?
Okay. I'm not known for brevity, but I'll do my best. So first is, if you care about the workforce, if you care about education, if you care about our poor health outcomes, if you care about local economy stimulus, then you care about food insecurity. And so if you think you don't, you need to reshape the way you think about it, because it's a foundational issue that undermines all of those other things. Second is, it does take effort at every level. And so if you're involved in your local pantry, that's great. And that is needed, and it meets a community need. But you should also vote in a way that makes sure that that pantry is not having to fill a gap that government really should be doing, right? You should be thinking about holding your elected officials accountable when they tell you they care about food insecurity and they come pack boxes at your local food bank and they vote against every single bill that supports folks who are struggling in poverty. And you should also know that when you pay your taxes, you are fighting hunger and you are fighting poverty. And we need to shift that perspective for folks, because that is where most of the resources come from, and it's important. And every time you hear somebody say, we're going to cut taxes, recognize that the programs that get cut first are all of those anti-poverty programs, which means you're going to need to donate more to your local charity to meet some of those needs, right? And then lastly, I would just say, I think we have come so far in the last 7 years as a state, from a government side and the private sector side, of working together, of not competing, but leveraging each other's strengths, and recognizing the value of those government programs. Frankly, like, the public debate has changed a little bit, and we cannot afford to regress. We have to keep moving forward. So.
Well, you've hit on my motto for next year, for 2024. It's voting has consequences. That's going to be my motto for the whole election year, is voting has consequences. So thank you very much. And I'm sure we'll be in touch. And I encourage everyone to read his op-ed this weekend and all the op-eds. So thank you very much. And I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too.